With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got you covered with comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and confident looks you can count on. For over a decade, Mack Weldon has designed timeless, innovative menswear to help you move through the day with confidence. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MAC25. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code MAC25.
Freedom at all costs. Sharif Amin's life took an unexpected turn when he signed up for a life-altering call for help from Ukraine. He was thrust into a world of turmoil, confronted with the plight of ordinary people ensnared in the throes of a merciless war. Delighted to be joining me live on the line is Sharif Amin himself. Sharif, good morning to me. Good morning to you.
Good morning, my good friend. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And thank you for joining me this morning. Whereabouts are you today?
I am in Ukraine, but I can't divulge the actual location.
Okay, no problem at all. I completely understand. Tell me a little bit about then how you ended up there, basically, and your experiences that led you to volunteer to go to Ukraine.
So after roughly about 10 years in the British Army, I left and became a close protection operative. And I was sat doing a job at a desk, some security job. I saw the Zelensky interview regarding asking for help in Ukraine. Now, I felt quite unfulfilled in the UK, and I felt that I had some skills that I possibly could help with. So I went onto all types of social media, and ironically enough, TikTok. I got hold of an American sailor who was out in the sea and explained to him what my idea was, and he managed to connect me with some people out in Ukraine, and it kind of escalated from there. I managed to get a team together of about 30 guys who wanted to do various different jobs out here, whether it was fighting, humanitarian aid, or training, and within a week, I was on a flight to Poland. It was rather sporadic and quite full-on. So we got to Poland, and we didn't know what was going to go on because we didn't have any contacts out there. And as we got across the border, we managed to flag down a random coach who took us to a place called Lviv. And we managed to bump into somebody who was in the Georgian Legion,
right,
who introduced us to some British and American guys. And it went from there.
Here's the thing to begin with, Sharif. Let's just make perfectly clear that you guys aren't mercenaries. You're not doing this. You're not soldiers of fortune. You're not a Ukrainian version of Wagner, are you?
Absolutely not. We went out there for the first year as volunteers. People sold their homes, their cars. They used their life savings. And for the first 6 months, we were delivering aid, medical and tactical aid. And we were training civilians to defend their cities. Then it sort of escalated to the territorial defense, where we started to train soldiers who had never had any experience before. So a few of us had extensive experience in Afghanistan and had been instructors before. So we carried on with the instructing before we actually went forward to defend some of the cities in Ukraine.
How did the Ukrainians take to, I mean, you mentioned there's a Georgian Legion in there. I know that the Canadians, Americans are over there as well on an independent capacity, because obviously the Home Office was saying don't go to Ukraine. Two questions. One, what was your first experience of Ukraine in the way that the Ukrainians greeted you? And two, what sort of level of preparation did you find there? Because if we cast our mind back to when we thought they were going to invade, the Russians were going to invade, there were all these, you know, there were all these images on our TV screens of Ukraine preparing and British officers being over there, British servicemen being over there in a training capacity.
Yes. Well, when we first got across there, I mean, our welcoming was very warm. There was many of the civilians, but obviously the military side of things were very dubious. We had been pulled out of our vehicles, questioned, and we must have had our passports checked. at least 100 times in the first week. And we were monitored, obviously, for good reason, and checked for good reason to begin with. But then after a while, they became very friendly with us on first-name terms. So the preparation, it was a bit all over the place. I mean, some areas were really well prepared. Some areas just wasn't really prepared for the amount of volunteers that were coming. So it took a while, a few months, before things fell into place and people started to trust the foreigners. Like I said, it was for all good reason. So, yeah, I mean, it was up and down. But regarding the way that the Ukrainians actually took us in, they fed us, they housed us. You know, they asked for our help. And if anything, they helped us more than we helped them to begin with.
When did you actually arrive in Ukraine? Because obviously when Russia first invaded, we thought, if you didn't know your logistics, and we didn't at the time, having seen those long convoys of Russian armour and support vehicles 40 miles from Kyiv, we thought, OK, well, they'll be in there by lunchtime. But what we didn't know at the time is they hadn't got any fuel in them or whatever. So when you got out, when did you actually get over there, and what sort of situations were you facing?
So it was just about 11 days after the war started. I needed to get my affairs together and obviously get this team together and quit my job. So, you know, the first things we faced was the uncertainty of what was happening. We didn't know if we crossed the border and there was going to be Russians attacking us straight away. We didn't know where we were going to stay. We didn't know anything like that. But when we first got there, we were stopped quite a lot of times. Some of the police were very full on. But the military themselves tried to assist us the best things we can. After training some soldiers, like when we first got into training the first lot of soldiers, we were told we had 30 soldiers to train. When we got there was five of us, we had 130 soldiers. But they were so susceptible. And these soldiers, these guys were like, normal day-to-day civilians who had been conscripted or volunteered. And they had about 12 days before they were going into battle. So for us to train them, they wanted us to do 6 months worth of NATO training in about 12 days, which is near impossible.
Right.
But with the 12 to 15 hour days we were doing with these guys, they went from civilians to pretty well-trained soldiers in a very short space of time because they needed to learn and they were very susceptible to what we were teaching them. It was full on. And when we finally went to the front line with them, there's nothing that can prepare you for what goes on. We're talking First World War trench, we're talking Second World War tanks, and we're talking, you know, modern day drones and technology. So I've been to Afghan a few times, and I've done a few training, a fair few training exercises, and I've been in combat. But nothing will prepare you for this level of war because it's fighting against a very powerful army, not just insurgents. And everything you can think of was thrown at us, and it's a shock to the system. But we were prepared for it.
Yeah, it's interesting because you said you'd been in Afghanistan, you'd been in that situation, and that's, if you like, is a different battlefield. This is a European battlefield, and I know if you were in the Army of the Rhine in the 80s and 90s, you were kind of getting ready for that sort of warfare. But I don't think you would have thought that you would have actually been fighting in trenches and fighting in a European city.
No, absolutely not. I mean, if you think about how things went in Iraq and Afghanistan, okay, initially in Iraq with the first Gulf War, there was tanks and everything else, but the Western civilization had the most power. Then you go to Afghanistan, and we had the tanks, we had the air support, we had the kit and equipment. And other than training, you can prepare for tanks shooting at you and a full-blown army against another full-blown army. It's a complete whole deal. The only way I can describe it is watching Band of Brothers or Saving Private Ryan. It gets like that. And no one can be prepared for that kind of battle. And it takes a while to be in that sort of environment before you come accustomed to it. And you never really do come fully accustomed to it because you're losing friends on a daily basis. Mm. And it's much more bloody and gory than anyone could possibly imagine.
And again, the problem with this is the fact that because of the indiscriminate fire that was coming in civilian areas. A very good friend of mine was a guy called Pierre Shevchowski, who was a Fox News cameraman who was killed in the first couple of days in Ukraine as well. And you got hit by shrapnel as well, didn't you? You got wounded over there.
Yeah, so on the final battle that I was in, it was one of the first counter-offensives after Nikolaev, and we'd been out for about 4 days and four nights of constant shelling, tank attacks, small arm fire, clearing villages, and we were going forward, and we pushed the furthest forward of any unit at the time, and unfortunately we got ambushed by a couple of tanks, artillery and machine gun fire. And as the first tank round hit, one of my friends was hit by the arm in his arm. Now, you know, I'm not a qualified medic, but I'm a team medic. So I was bandaging his arm. And then from that point on, we had about 20 minutes with fire for effect of artillery fire, tank fire. And we were in a very small trench, just knee high, because they'd only just started digging it. And I was face to face with a colleague of mine, professor, a Ukrainian. And the rounds were landing like 10 meters, 5 meters. I got blown off my feet, ended up in the trench. And then a round landed right next to us, which unfortunately killed my friend instantly. So I was hit with an artillery round. And as I was crawling out of the trench, they opened fire and hit me three times with small arms fire. So my injuries were large pieces of shrapnel through my leg, which paralyzed my right leg. I was shot in the arm. Most of my right arm was torn open. I lost my thumb. I had 19 pieces of metal in my back, and both my lungs were punctured. Then I was shot in my left arm, and then I was disemboweled. So it was. I'm lucky to be alive, to be honest with you.
And yet you're back there.
yes, of course.
Yeah, and I mean, it takes... Most people would have said, "Okay, that's me done." You know, I mean, with the greatest of you know, the greatest respect. And listen, I'm taking my hat off to you right now. But did you? The reason you go back is because you've been there before. You know, you were there the first time round. You saw what impact you're having. You're seeing the struggles that men and women. Because let's not forget this struggle. This war has brought the women into combat roles, not just as medics, but on the front line as well. Yeah. And they are fighting like she devils over there. So I mean, is that what brings you back? Because you now have a. If you like a personal, there's a personal engagement with it there for you, Sharif. Yeah,
absolutely. So I'll give you an idea. In my book, The Freedom of All Costs, there's a full chapter about the women of Ukraine, and there's the NGOs and the women of Ukraine. Vika, she was one of the first women I trained to use a rifle. She's an absolute hero. And she took me around some of the villages and cities while I wasn't in a combat role. And there were so many men that had gone to war or absconded from the country or had been killed. And the women there were making ghillie suits for snipers and camouflage. And, you know, the old babushkas were making bread. And, you know, they were going out and helping with all the medical situation, as well as being on the front line. And there is... that this war could not be upheld in the way it is being upheld unless it was for the women and the older people and the NGOs out here. It isn't just the soldiers on the front line. And I fell in love with the people here. On my 40th birthday, after a few weeks here, it was the first villagers I went to train. And on the first morning, they came out with a birthday cake for me and sang happy birthday. They didn't have any produce. They didn't have anything there, but they managed to put a cake together for me. And that same evening, they sang happy birthday again. I had gifts like football scarves, and even one young lass, she must have been about 3 or 4. She gave me her only Hot Wheels, still in the packet, as a gift. And at the time, booze was illegal, but because we were in a village, they had their only little bottle of cognac and some homemade alcohol. And I had my first borscht, which is a local type soup, a red soup. And they held a huge party for me in this little village. And I'd never had that before in my life. You know, I've never really been celebrated by a bunch of people that I'd never met before. And it was so heartwarming at that point. I fell in love with the country, and I made so many commitments by the time I'd been hit that I couldn't bring myself to not come back and come and see my friends for a start, and re-support the civilians. And even if I'm not able to fight in the same capacity as I was before, I can still go to the front line. We evacuated a few soldiers recently. Mm. We managed to deliver some incubators to some hospitals. And I went to visit the hospitals that actually saved my life. And we managed to get through ReactAid a ultrasound, because they were using one ultrasound for the whole hospital. And this guy, he took so much pain from me with his anesthesia, but he was struggling. And I promised him I'd try to get him one. It took a year, but we finally got him a portable ultrasound, and he was the happiest man alive. So, yeah, there are multiple reasons why I wanted to come back, not just because I wanted to fight or anything like that. It was, I believe the people here need as much help as possible. And now through media, I'm able to keep things alive in the public eye and keep the support going as best I can through book, through media, like for yourself speaking to you right now. Because the last thing we want is people to forget about what's really going on. Because as far as I'm concerned, Ukraine is now the front line for Europe. That's the way I see it. And Ukraine's not just fighting for their freedom. I believe they're fighting for Europe's freedom.
And this is the thing. John Sweeney, who I've interviewed quite a few times, he was giving us live updates from Kyiv during the first couple of months of the war. He was chatting to him yesterday, and he said the problem that they're worried about is the fact that they're worried that people will forget about it, or just it will go into stalemate. And winter is now coming. It means the Russians are going to start, you know, bombing again to make life even more uncomfortable for the Ukrainians over there.
Water, electric, everything that happened last time. Yeah, yeah. It's going to be difficult.
And surely that's going to be what we need to do is make sure that people don't forget about Ukraine, because as you said, it's the front line of Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the reasons why I wrote the book, it wasn't to make money for myself or anything like that. I was sat in hospital, and a friend of mine, Sonny Davola, he was a soldier in the British Army with me, but he's kind of acting like a manager for me, free of charge, but he's been great. And he kind of convinced me to write this book. And, you know, the most amazing thing was I was able to express myself in a book over time and explain a lot of what was going on out here. Mm. And this book will be there forever, you know, and people can buy the book. People can, and a lot of it's going to charity, and people can read about the humanity. It's not just a book about war. It's a book about people's lives here. And there are parts in the book people are speaking for themselves, like I said, the women and the NGOs and personal people. So having like YouTube and TikTok and everything like that, doing memorials and trying to get it into the public eye. I'm just one person, but if there's not many people I can reach out to, it's gonna keep it alive in people's eyes, because we need to make sure that people know what's going on out here and don't just think it's like a fad and it's over. I'll explain something if you allow me to just have a couple of seconds. After about 6 months of being out here, someone asked me in England if I could come down to the pub with them for a beer, and I told them I was in Ukraine, and they said, "That's still going on, is it?" And I thought, well, that ain't right. So that's when I realized we needed to keep awareness, you know, strong for what's going on.
The book is called Freedom at All Costs. It's by Sharif Amin, who we're speaking to today. Sharif, if people want to, you mentioned the social medias and the TikToks. Where's the best place to find you? I mean, obviously, you're not going to be doing live streaming from where you are at the moment for very obvious reasons. But do you have a social media presence? Where can people find you online?
So TikTok is the best place. So it's at Sharif.Amin, at Sharif.Amin. And to buy the book will be on my web page, which will be sharifamin.com. That's sharifamin.com. Or if you need to and you're abroad somewhere and you're struggling, you can get it on Amazon.
Right. And so it's also going to be available as we'll put it on our own virtual bookstore, Sharif, so people can download it directly from the radio station as well, mate.
Sure. I was wondering before you go, do you have a link to this radio station or a copy of this interview?
I will make sure that my demon producers get that over to Sharif, okay? Listen.
I really appreciate your time in talking to me about this. It means more than you realize. And there are so many people out here, Americans, Canadians, British, you name it, Georgians, everyone is here doing their part, NGOs, and they're really working hard to make sure that the people's lives here are a little bit better. So for your interview today, It means so much to the people of Ukraine and to myself. So thank you so much.
Sharif, it has been a pleasure and an honor to speak to you today. Sharif Amin, live from Ukraine, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, sir.